This is a CBC podcast. Check the weather in a pinch before you run out the door with CBC Weather. Be sure to bookmark your community at cbc.ca/weather.
Hello, I'm Helen Mann.
Good evening, I'm Barbara Budd. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
unintended consequences. Toyota applies the brakes to its vehicle production following a sudden unintended acceleration problem, also known as out-of-control gas pedals in some of its cars.
The healing and the hurt, the wrenching experience of a nurse from Newfoundland who tended to those wounded in the earthquake in Haiti.
General discontent. Sri Lanka's former army chief finds his hotel surrounded by troops after he contests his loss in the country's presidential election.
Remember the Black Sabbath and Keep It Holy. British headbangers devote themselves to getting heavy metal recognized as an official religion. As It Happens, the podcast edition radio that says, if you accept Judas Priest as your personal savior, I admire your metal. It's a car problem called sudden unintended acceleration, and it's created a real business problem for Toyota. Sudden unintended acceleration happens when a gas pedal sticks and causes runaway acceleration. It's already led to the biggest recall in Toyota history, and now the automaker has taken the unprecedented step of halting the sale and production of 8 of its models. Sean Kane is an independent vehicle safety researcher. We reached him today in Washington.
Mr. Kane, when did this problem first appear in Toyota vehicles?
You know, the problem really starts to show up in the complaint data around 2002, 2003. Many years ago, this is a problem that's been, really festering beneath the surface in Toyota and Lexus models for some time.
Well, how many of these incidents have involved serious problems, injuries, and deaths?
Well, right now, we have documented at least 18 fatalities. You know, I'm fairly confident that that's an undercount because, before much of the publicity, there wasn't the kind of investigation and evaluation of unintended acceleration events post-crash.
What is the pattern in these cases? What actually happens to the vehicle?
Well, what's interesting about this and what's so complicated about it is there's a multitude of patterns that have emerged. We see both long-duration events, we're seeing short-duration, and I think what we're also documenting is that because it's across a number of year makes and models, there is no one root cause. You know, Toyota would have us believe that this was all formats, at least as of a couple months ago. They've now changed their position to saying it's formats and accelerator pedals. But the reality is there's more to it. There are incidents that cannot be explained by either one of those mechanical interfaces.
Why do they throw out the floor mat theory? Because they would, as you say, stuck by that for a while.
It was obvious by our own investigations that floor mats were not the only cause. In fact, they're probably a cause that was certainly occurring, but maybe not even the lion's share of the events that we're seeing were caused by floor mats. So, it's very curious to me to see a company trying to paper this over. I think it's also taken back consumers who have really held Toyota out as a very different company from other car companies where they've expected, the kind of nonsense we've heard, from other companies. They don't expect that from Toyota.
You also dismissed to some degree the idea of these faulty pedals. The company that manufactures them, which is based in Indiana, actually the parts, though, are assembled in Ontario. And the company is saying that it's puzzled by this recall today. It's saying it actually has only been informed by Toyota of 8 vehicle incidents involving stuck pedals, and none of those involved injuries or fatalities. So what do you make of that?
I'm not terribly surprised to hear that because, from what we're seeing, the incidents that we've examined and certainly from the interviews we've done with consumers and cars we've examined, I just don't see this pedal problem being the predominant cause. In fact, what we see is it's just really kind of tangential. Is it another root cause? Well, sure, we'll take it at its word that it can cause this problem, and we're glad to see that they're doing some kind of remedy. But is it really getting at the root of what's happening? And I think, the answer is probably not. It looks like it's another red herring.
So what do you think the real problem is?
Well, again, I think we have to look at this in context. We are not seeing one singular root cause. I think floor mats are certainly a cause. It's entirely possible these petals are a cause. But many of the incidents that we've examined certainly have all of the telltales of electronic-related defects. And those could come in a number of different forms. In the past, Toyota has actually done technical bulletins to reflash the algorithms in their electronic control units to prevent unintended acceleration incidents. In fact, on 2002 and 2003 Camrys, the company issued a bulletin to its dealers telling them that if consumers report complaints of unintended acceleration while traveling between 38 and 42 miles an hour, reflash the computer with this algorithm and that'll fix the problem.
So isn't there a big risk here that they find a solution to this sticking pedal and that doesn't resolve the problem? We see further incidents, possibly even further deaths.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see, unfortunately, here, Ellen, is that there's going to be additional recalls. They're going to cover other models and it's going to unwind over time. The credibility of this company is really going out the window very, very quickly. Consumers have been told one thing, it's floor mats. Now that's shifting. Now we're on to accelerator pedals, and even that's shifting. The company is now saying it's examining other issues. Yet they can't keep this up for much longer without really losing some significant trust in what they're doing. I think what's more hopeful out of any of the actions that Toyota has taken is in the November recall, the company has indicated that in addition to replacing floor mats, they're going to provide a retrofit for a brake override system. You may have heard about this, sometimes called a smart pedal, where there's an electronic system that in the event that there's a conflict between the accelerator pedal and the brake application, the engine will always return to idle. So in other words, if the pedal is being depressed, whether it's by an errant floor mat, by a mistaken foot, or by other electronic means, there's a separate system that will bring that engine down to idle if and when the driver depresses the brake, which most drivers report doing. And I think that will solve much of their problem. The issue, though, is that they're only retrofitting that electronic fix to a handful of vehicles in their November recall. There has been an indication from the company that they're going to expand that to include other models and that they're going to include that on new Toyota and Lexus models coming out. That may be one of the more important fixes to the problem.
Much is being made of the fact that this is such a big move by Toyota, and if not completely unprecedented, extremely rare that a company would do something like this. But did they have any choice?
I don't think they really did. I think, Toyota was trying to manage a crisis that was quickly getting out of their control, and I think it is out of their control right now. Unfortunately for Toyota, when they submitted that recall, the repercussions of that may not have been thought out because under U.S. regulations, if they have a known defect and a remedy for it, they identify that in the recall documents to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, then the company's obliged to stop selling the cars.
You've suggested how devastating this is to Toyota's reputation. And beyond fixing the problem itself with these vehicles, what kind of damage control can they do? Can they actually do enough to maintain their position as the world's largest automaker?
The damage control for Toyota is really secondary. The real issue is what can they do to take care of consumers? They put consumers in this precarious position. They've neglected this problem for years and papered it over. And now we have a perfect storm for this company. And, what are they going to do for consumers who now, have real concerns about how to control their vehicle, what's going to happen? And there are no easy answers. It's complicated. It's messy. It's going to include multiple recalls over time. And it's going to include a lot more models, I think, than we've seen.
Sean Kane, thank you for your input on all of this. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for calling.
All right. Goodbye.
Good day now.
Sean Kane is president of Safety Research and Strategy, an independent consulting group, and we reached him in Washington. Thank you. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day. All across the world, survivors from the Nazi death camps have been among those commemorating the 65th anniversary of their liberation. In the aftermath of the camp's liberation, an American academic named Dr. David Baudure toured Europe, gathering testimony from those who had survived the genocide. Equipped with a tape recorder, Dr. Baudure interviewed about 130 people between July and October 1946. And the stories that Dr. Baudure discovered were poignant and often harrowing. The majority of these recordings have been put online as the Voices of the Holocaust Project, curated by the Paul V. Galvin Library at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Here is Otto Feuer, an Austrian survivor of the Dachau camp, speaking to Dr. Baudure on August 22, 1946. It is a recording made almost 65 years ago.
I don't want to talk what they have done to me. I want to talk what they have done to all of us, and for instance, what they have done to Min. I don't even want to talk Min, to Min in general, to German Min, to
anyone. To men.
Yes. I want to tell you how they succeeded in changing the brains of normal men. I should like to give you some examples. One example. It was one of the most powerful experiences I had in Dachau. We were working. And of course, we were awfully ill-treated. One day, it was in summer, in May 41 about, I was standing there together working with a friend of mine, a comrade of mine, when the SS man came, and the young SS man, he had about 20 years, he came in behind us, and he called my comrade, "Come, will you put your hands on your trousers?" Well, then he had him stand behind a ditch of water about a depth of 2 meters. Yeah. And when he stands there with the hands on his trousers, he kicked him into his stomach that he fell into this ditch. Then he took a club, and pushed him down. At any rate, he pushed him 3 times, 4 times, as long as it was necessary, until this man was drowned. Then he called me. Now, of course, I was ready to have now the same experience, but now I pulled him out, and I had to put him on a little car, and I had to bring him into the camp. Yeah. That's not so awful, but the most awful thing is that now on the way, this SS man, a boy of about 20 years, he began to tell me how awfully unhappy he was. He had an appointment for the same evening with his sweetheart, and now he has been ordered that he would have to do duty, and he couldn't go to his date. He was speaking to me without any consciousness that he just had committed a murder.
That was a recording of Holocaust survivor Otto Feuer speaking to American academic Dr. David Baudure in August 1946. Dr. Baudure recorded more than 100 interviews with survivors of the Holocaust between July and October of that year. That recording was given to us with the permission of the Voices of Holocaust Project, which is curated by the Paul V. Galvin Library at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And you can access the project and the recordings of Dr. Baudure online at voices.iit.edu. We're going to post that link on our website as well. A winner has been declared in Sri Lanka's presidential election, but the contest is anything but settled. Earlier today, Sri Lanka's election commissioner declared the incumbent, Mahinda Rajapaksa, the victor by a wide margin. But his main political rival, the former head of the military, refused to accept the results. A few hours later, General Sarath Fonseca found his hotel in Colombo surrounded by soldiers. The military says that several hundred army deserters are holed up inside the building with the general. Johan Pereira is a senior journalist with Sri Lanka's Daily Mirror newspaper. We reached him in Colombo earlier today.
Johan, what is it like in Colombo tonight?
There are celebrations, mainly by the supporters of the government, with lighting of fireworks and going into the streets. There is also tension outside the city hotel where the main candidate is supposed to be staying. And he claims that he is under arrest and the government troops are not allowing him to move about freely. He also said this evening that he will not accept the results of the election and claimed that there was some rigging and some illegal things happening while the election results were declared.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he will take legal action. He will go to courts and get the courts to declare the election null and void.
How many troops are outside Fonseca's hotel?
I would say around 1,000.
So it's a considerable presence. Now, what about his supporters? Are they outside the hotel as well?
Well, his main supporters, the main political party leaders who supported him, were with him this evening.
And when you say there is tension then outside the hotel, are there any clashes?
Yeah. The roads which leads to the hotel are closed and people are sort of confused, wondering as to what is going to happen.
Are people afraid that Fonseca, as a former general, will be able to lead those troops in some kind of coup?
Well, he said that he will try to leave, and also he indicated that he is willing to negotiate with the government and come to some sort of settlement where he will be free to go. And there was some allegations regarding him keeping some army deserters and some armed men, which he categorically denied. With regard to that, he said he is willing to negotiate, but at the same time he said he has only two options. One is to retaliate and other is to surrender himself.
And what, by retaliation, what does he mean? Does he have the hearts of the military and the people?
Well, he said that if the troops fire, he will fire back or something. That's what he meant.
That sounds frightening.
It's frightening, somewhat frightening. But the government, of course, is saying that he's not under arrest and he's free to go. And the government says that they only want him to release those army deserters.
You say that Fonseca says this vote was not fair, but Rajapaksa has been declared the winner by quite a considerable margin. It's not a narrow victory. The election commissioner says that there's no question that Rajapaksa won. So what do the people think? Do they trust that this was a fair election?
Well, some people have accepted the result, but few of them have doubts, I would say, very few of them. Maybe the journalists and, you know, the learned community in Sri Lanka, the educated class, some of them is not accepting it. The ordinary people are accepting, majority of them.
Were there independent election monitors keeping an eye on things?
There were from several countries, but they have not come out with their reports or comments as yet. By tomorrow, they will come out with their conclusions.
So there must be quite a bit of anticipation about those results then.
Quite a bit of anticipation, yes. There is a lot of anticipation, a lot of speculation.
These two men used to be allies. They both claimed victory in the war against Tamil Tiger rebels last year. And then they ended up in this bitter election battle. What happened? Why the split?
The split, we were made to understand that there was something personal. Nobody exactly knows what happened. There are speculations, major speculations.
Mm-hmm. How did President Rajapaksa manage to pull off this victory then? How did he win?
I think he managed to defeat the Tigers and, you know, end the war, the 30-year-old war, and that appealed to the people, especially the majority community. Basically, that was it. I think because his campaign was based on it. He claimed that he liberated the country and he promised to bring about economic development. I think those things appealed to the people.
The economy is in trouble. I understand the cost of living is very high in Sri Lanka.
Cost of living is very high, but according to the economists here, the country has achieved nearly around 4% or 5% economic growth.
Really? And yeah. And presumably President Rajapaksa has been able to take credit for that?
I would say so, yes. He claims credit, at least.
Tell me what you're anticipating might be the next move in all of this.
Next move, I don't know. It may be a possible arrest of Fonseca, or maybe they negotiate and settle something and he will be free to go. When it comes to politics, I think discussions are going on. Probably he will remain in politics, continue to work with the opposition parties who backed him.
Johan Pereira, thank you so much for filling us in on what's happening there tonight.
Okay, thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Johan Pereira is a senior journalist with Sri Lanka's Daily Mirror newspaper. We reached him in Colombo. Oh, we have all waited for a bus that didn't come, bracing ourselves against the elements, complaining to anyone within earshot about the inconvenience and the poor service. But one transit rider in Montreal has taken his frustrations to the next level. Professor Jeremy Cooperstock decided to take Montreal's Public Transport Commission, the STM, to small claims court after continually paying cab fares when his bus just failed to show up. We reached Professor Cooperstock at his home in Montreal.
Professor Cooperstock, first of all, let me just clarify, you're not a law professor, are you?
No, I'm not.
You're not a serial litigator?
I am, yes, I confess.
You are?
Yes, I'm somewhat of a consumer rights advocate.
Now, why did the transit system in Montreal come into your targets?
Well, it was a matter of systematic late buses or buses failing to show up on schedule. That is, over a half-hour period, let's say, where two or three buses were scheduled, having none of them show up at all. And that, to me, is a violation of a contract when I purchase a monthly bus pass. And there is an advertised schedule that is posted both on the signs in front of the bus shelter and on their website and available by telephone. Then if they fail to provide that service in reasonable time, then that there are financial issues at stake when a customer has to pay for a taxi instead.
How often have you had to resort to the taxi option?
Probably half a dozen times over the last few years.
Besides the cold and the obvious frustration of being late, what kind of problems has this bus service caused you?
On my end, it's really just been a matter of stress and wasted time. Missed taking my son to a hockey game one night and had to rush madly to class to be there on time. But that's really been the extent of my damages.
And how old is your son?
I've got 1 3 and 1 5-year-old.
Oh, right. And they don't like standing around in the cold. I know that.
Not
for sure.
Not particularly. And this was actually happening from the time that one of them was just starting daycare, so at the age of 1 year old. And when you time it to arrive at the bus a few minutes before its scheduled arrival, and you wait for 15 minutes with two buses scheduled in that period, neither of them showing up, that starts to become a problem in terms of the one-year-old.
I travel regularly on a streetcar line that is notorious in this city for its service. Is this the case with this bus route of yours, or is this seeming to be a universal problem with the bus system in Montreal?
Well, I first was not a bus commuter. I live very close to the university where I worked for many years. And my wife was the one who was commuting, and she had a bus that was supposed to show up once every half hour, and they would just randomly pull a bus without alerting anybody, so the customer would be waiting there for 1 hour. Now that starts to become a real problem.
Mm-hmm. So tell me how you started the process of complaining. Did you write letters? Did you phone them?
Right. I did all of the above. The STM, like most big companies, has a link for sending complaints. And the first few times I did that, it would take some time to get a response. And I think the first time that I was dissatisfied with the response, which was the generic, we've looked into the matter, but we've decided it's not our responsibility, I decided after I had to take a taxi or two to send them a registered letter intimating legal action. And at that point, they took me a little more seriously, and they sent me a number of bus vouchers that were equivalent in value to the taxi fare I paid. And then a few years passed without any serious incidents, and then we're back to last year when a number of late buses necessitated my taking taxis on several occasions.
So when did you decide that this was a small claims matter?
After sending them, I think, a series of three complaints in a succession of a few months, and all of them meeting the same response, it's not our responsibility. And then on follow-up, they provided various excuses, and I was dissatisfied with the level of detail in those excuses, so I sent in an access to information request for their documentation regarding the supposed reasons of either congestion or traffic light problems or bus driver not being available and so on. Mm-hmm. And none of the documentation they provided actually covered the supposed excuses they had. So I realized that they were just giving me the standard form letter and hadn't really looked into the matter. And I felt at that point that legal action was perhaps necessary.
How far did this legal proceeding go?
Just to the filing. Once I filed the action in small claims court and they received notice, they were quite quick to settle with me.
And how much did they settle for?
The cost of the two taxis that were within the statute of limitations period, which was, I think, only going back about 2 or 3 years, plus the registered mailing costs of the notice of demand and notice of claim and the court filing fee. So it was in total $128 that they had to pay, but I was only out of pocket from taxi fares for about $20, $24, $25.
Is getting your money back good enough?
No, I mean, the $100 or whatever it was is really not, for somebody who has a reasonable job, not a big deal. What I would like to see is reliable and consistent bus service that doesn't inconvenience not just myself, but the general traveling public. And my hope is certainly not to compel the STM to declare bankruptcy. I'd much rather see a reliable service that benefits the community. And hopefully this can serve as a wake-up call for them, and perhaps the same in other cities like Toronto, as you're saying, if you're having a poor streetcar service there. I'm sure it's not a problem that's confined to Montreal.
Jeremy Cooperstock, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was McGill University professor Jeremy Cooperstock, and he was speaking from Montreal. Humanitarian work continues in Haiti more than 2 weeks after the devastating earthquake. International medical crews are continuing to treat those injured in the quake. Now, gangrene and dehydration are becoming real problems. The work is hard, but it's even harder when there is little that medics can do. Rick Bishop is a nurse originally from Newfoundland, and he's just returned from Haiti, where he worked at a makeshift hospital set up by Israeli doctors. We reached him at his home in Palm Beach, Florida.
Rick Bishop, tell me what made you decide to go to Haiti?
And that's a very emotional thing. It was moved by the people that I work with that are from Haiti, and then finding out that their loved ones are lost.
Tell us what kind of work you were doing there then.
Just in a makeshift tent. I give thanks to the Israelis and to the France and the heart of heart of the Foundation of In America. Just caring for people, just simple people off the street. And you didn't care who they were or what they were. But they were crying out for you to, just tug on your shoulder and say, well, you need to look at. And there were times that you felt insubordinated because that you couldn't offer the care of what you knew that you could give because of lack of supplies or facilities and all that sort of stuff.
That must be incredibly hard, knowing that if you were somewhere else, you could help people so much more.
If we were in Canada, we would be able to deliver the best possible medicine. If we were in the United States, we would be able to offer the best possible medicine. And working with these people of Haitians, they brought me so much life. What you start, you finish. And that was always bred into me by my family, by my friends, by my mother and my father. And so it's like you don't give up.
Tell me about some of the people whom you met, who you helped down there, and what you learned of them.
It's pretty hard to know that they're going to lose that leg tomorrow because we don't have the facilities to keep that foot. And then you walk up the street just a little bit, just outside of the stadium, and there was a boy of, I don't know how old, but his dad was dying. He was dragging him down the street in his arms and placed him on the table. He was so demaciated and so crushed. To know the next morning that little boy was still laying over his dad and he was dead. And we knew that was going to happen. But yet we just comforted him. He could not save him, no. And we saw that every morning when we went into work. So many people in the streets just looking, where do I go?
What do you say to people in those circumstances?
I am so sorry. God bless.
A lot of medical workers, you know, were so frustrated from what I was seeing by the harsh conditions, the lack of supplies. Did things improve during the time you were there, or were you basically always feeling like you were just, you know, making do?
Making do. It was totally making do. The Israelis, France, and God bless the Israelis and France, and they're still there. They've gone up to the countryside in the worst or horrible situation right now, and if I were there right now, I would be right beside them. I applaud them for what they do.
Why did you leave?
Just because of circumstance and fear of rioting.
So was it your experience that people knew there was aid, but it just wasn't getting to them? Or?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Yes, they know the tarmac is full. And they're suffering. They're suffering so horribly.
Tell me how you felt leaving that behind and flying home.
Oh, to cry so hard. There were two little boys. We have no idea whatsoever of how they ended up on our flight. They're 7 and 12 years old, and this is a missionary flight. And they happened to show up on the flight, the two little boys. One little boy had a visa and a passport, and so he was good to go. But he would not leave his brother. His passport was buried with his mom and his dad and his other siblings. And so the only other close siblings were in Miami. And I have no idea how they got on that flight. But all of a sudden, it's like you saw two little Haitian boys sitting on the flight across the aisle. And they were strapped in. And they were taken off the flight.
So they were not allowed to go to Miami?
No.
Do you know what happened to them?
I know these people, they will be fed, they will be comforted, and they will stay with these people until they are flying out.
Okay, well, that's something that must make you feel at least some relief.
Yeah, but taking off at the airport that morning or that afternoon at 5 o'clock, yeah, you could hear so many sobs of just two little boys being taken off that flight, and any one of us. Any one of us of the 28 people that were on that flight would have taken them and just claimed them and passed them off to, you know, immigration naturalization in America.
Do you have plans to do this kind of relief nursing again?
Yeah, I do. I have to go back to Haiti first.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing your experience with us. I know it's been difficult to talk about yet again. I'm sure it will continue to be, but I think it's good that we get to hear what you saw and experienced. Thank you so much.
I thank you as well. I thank you for your opportunity to talk about my experience and hopefully Canada, and I know that Canada is a great supporter, and they're very much talked about down here in Haiti, and you are so loved.
Take care, Rick.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Nurse Rick Bishop from Newfoundland has just returned to his home in Florida after treating patients in Haiti. He was in Palm Beach, Florida. The proroguing of Parliament and the resulting lack of political debate in the House of Commons is disturbing to many Canadians, as protests held across the country last weekend showed. However, things such as international treaty negotiations continue whether or not MPs are gathered in Ottawa. And that includes the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement talks which resumed this week in Guadalajara, Mexico. ACTA, as it's called, will set new international guidelines for internet use, especially how people upload and download things. Although the negotiations are being conducted in secret, leaked documents have shown that some extraordinary measures may be included in the treaty, measures aimed at curbing internet piracy. But these measures also might hurt people who are using the web legally. Charlie Angus has been following the issue closely. He's the NDP MP for Timmins James Bay, and we reached him at his home in Cobalt, Ontario.
Charlie Angus, before we get to your specific concerns, can you give us some background here? There have been some leaks around this treaty. What is believed to be contained in the ACTA at this point?
Well, the latest round of the anti-counterfeiting treaty agreement is now underway in Mexico, and it's been under a really heavy veil of secrecy, which is pretty odd. When the previous treaty on intellectual property, the WIPO treaty, was negotiated, it was very public. But this is very much, you know, on the QT, strictly hush-hush. We've gotten a number of leaks that have come out that are very disturbing, because we talk about counterfeiting, we're thinking about international counterfeiting gangs, and yet it seems that a lot of this is going to be focused on trying to put the digital genie back in the bottle of really blurring the distinctions between what individuals do at home and treating them as though they were a threat, copyright threat, in terms of counterfeit infringement. So,
why is that? Who's driving this?
This has really been driven by the U.S. corporate lobby. There's been a lot of attempts over the last number of years to turn back the clock on what's happened in terms of people's digital access, movies, downloading, etc. And at the same time, there's been a lot of other push, I think, very from the grassroots in that, to say we need to get some more progressive copyright, make sure artists are paid, but not treating average kids like they're criminals. And that's really where Canada is at the point. We are at the point of possibly coming forward with a good model for copyright, but this treaty being behind closed doors would actually undermine any domestic ability to set law, and would actually, I think, from what I'm reading, seriously override fundamental Canadian rights.
Can you give me some specific concerns about what kind of impact you think it would have on individual Canadians?
Well, part of it is really opening the door for corporate interests to go after claims of potential infringement, and that doesn't necessarily mean commercial. You're not counterfeiting. It could be your kid downloading and trading some Jonas Brothers MP3s. So requiring the telecom, your cable company, to basically spy on what you're doing and give up information on your use. The issue of possible search and seizure of iPods and laptops at the border to allow them to search for what's on your hard drive or on your iPod. One of the most disturbing is this notion of a three strikes and you're out policy, so that if, your kid downloads two MP3 files and then downloads a movie, and then you suddenly get told by your cable company that you're no longer allowed to use the Internet, that has major implications in terms of privacy rights, in terms of process, and also would... If if we're going to be moving forward as a in a 21st century economy, this kind of regressive policy would pose major stumbling blocks.
As I understand it, after that third strike, your household would not be allowed to have internet services from any provider. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you would be persona non grata in the digital world. Well, I mean, people do their work. They do their banking. You know, and the corporate copyright lobbyists, if they ever came out of the shadows and fessed up, would claim that there would be due process, but that's really highly unlikely. But the bigger issue here is this is not something that Peter Van Loan, the trade minister, or Stephen Harper has a mandate to do. We cannot be overriding Canadian domestic law in a closed-door set of meetings in Mexico.
But the government has said that the treaty will be subservient to any law passed within this country. You've already said you don't believe that. Why is that?
Well, the real problem is it's a pretty hollow claim to say that Canadian law will not be subservient to ACTA. But if we signed on international trade commitments before we've had a chance to develop the copyright laws that the government has promised would be done in public consultations, it's extremely unlikely that the government would then, having signed ACTA, turn around and tell their international partners that they're about to breach international obligations. So this has to be debated. It has to come out in public.
Other countries have come forward to say that they're uncomfortable with the provision you referred to, this three strikes, you're out position. Do you have any idea where the Canadian government stands on that?
The Canadian government has gone to ground. They're being very silent. I really think that as citizens find out about this, this treaty will get blown out of the water because it is so outrageous. I mean, if it was a legitimate process, it would be done in the eye of the public, but it's not.
Why do you think it's so secret?
It's secretive because it's really the U.S. corporate lobby trying to get their way. They know that there's not a democratically elected government in the world that would support some of these outrageous claims. So it's being done through trade treaty negotiations behind closed doors. One of the European activists said that the only response to this is the vampire solution, that as we expose these negotiations to daylight, the main players are going to start to melt away. And so that's my challenge. I've written a pretty comprehensive letter to Minister Van Loan saying the process has gone on for 3 years. You're getting now down to brass tacks. It's time to bring the treaty to the Canadian public and bring it to them. And if it's going to be a legitimate treaty, it has to be brought before any of these kind of backroom deals are made.
How has the proroguing of Parliament affected this?
Well, I'm very concerned that we have Minister Van Loan's officials sneaking around Mexico behind closed doors when us, the parliamentarians who were elected to ask questions of the government, are sitting outside the House of Commons. We need to be able to ask. This is what, you know, question period's for. I want to press Minister Van Loan. I want to find out the details. With a prorogued parliament, we're not sure how far Canada will go in terms of finalizing some of the details of this agreement before parliamentarians have a chance to even comment.
Charlie Angus, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much. You have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Charlie Angus is the Member of Parliament for Timmins, James Bay. He was at his home in Cobalt, Ontario. We called Trade Minister Peter Van Loan for comment on this issue, but received no response. It's been decried as evil, satanic, even as plain stupid. Heavy metal has long been the scourge of religions across the globe. Now, metal fans in the UK are turning the tables. They want their musical devotion recognized as a religion in its own right. British metalheads are encouraging fellow headbangers to enter their religion as heavy metal in the country's 2011 census, giving credence to the lives they lead and the rock gods they follow. Are they for real or just full of Aerosmith? Alexander Marlis is editor of the magazine Metal Hammer, and he's pioneering the campaign. We reached him in London.
Mr. Milas, are you serious?
No, not at all. I mean, this is an idea that came together in a pub one night. You know, we were about three pints in, and we thought it'd be really funny. I mean, the thing is, you know, there's always, you know, an element of seriousness to anything like this. Our entire motive is simply amusement, and that's it. You know, we don't mean to disrespect any other organized religions, people's belief systems, and all that. But at the same time, we want to acknowledge that heavy metal is a huge global phenomenon. I mean, it started 40 years ago. It's selling out stadiums from Mumbai to Sao Paulo to Tokyo. This is a big thing we're talking about. And, you know, this is just a great way to kind of celebrate just what a wonderful thing this music is.
And it's a great publicity stunt, too, huh?
Well, you know, it's been interesting. You know, I mean, to say I'm surprised would be a pretty huge understatement. Like in the last week since we started our Facebook page, which is a heavy metal for the 2011 census, we've had over 10,000 people join. So I'm over the moon about it, and I think it just goes to show that there are these fans out there, that this is as big as we think it is.
I think I know in my mind what heavy metal sounds like, but define for me what heavy metal is.
Well, you know, I think it goes beyond just a sound, you know. I mean, it does go up to 11. I mean, just like any Black Sabbath or Iron Maiden or Metallica tune pretty much sums up what it's all about. But it's also a culture as well. You know, I can go to pretty much any city in the world, and I will see someone wearing a band T-shirt. And even though I don't know who they are, we'll kind of give each other a nod, like an acknowledgement, because we know that we're on the same team, that we listen to the same music, and we probably are into the same sorts of things, you know. So it is a culture as well. It's like a lifestyle or a state of mind for a lot of people. It doesn't go beyond that. It's simply a fun thing to do, and it is a community that goes around the entire world.
So you don't really think heavy metal needs to be acknowledged as a religion?
No, not at all. I just think it would be terrific if it actually got on the census.
Why do you want to know so much how many people would define themselves as heavy metalists?
This is the ideal time to see, 40 years on, what is this form of music that constantly is kind of put within this rubric of being under threat, as though it's just about to blink under existence. I mean, I don't believe that at all. I think metal is bigger than it ever has been. And it's just a great way to kind of highlight that for the fans.
Are there any famous metalheads backing this campaign of yours?
Well, you know, we talked to Biff from Saxon, and, you know, we just kind of said jokingly to him, okay, so if this thing comes off, will you be a World Metal Peace Ambassador? Because we just want to make sure that there's kind of like a sort of figurehead who can just sort of like calm anyone's fears about like what our motives are and all that. But no, I mean, we're not ordaining priests. You know, there is no structure to this. Our only commandment is just listen to heavy metal, everything louder than everything else, and that's pretty much where it ends.
Would that be the cornerstone of your faith then?
Oh, absolutely. Just listening to loud music. That's all we're about. That's all that defines heavy metal, is liking really loud stuff, and that's it.
And where would people worship?
Well, I think it happens pretty much every time people go to a gig. You know, you see this congregation of people, you know, just, you know, throwing the horns at the stage and all that, and it's just a really fun thing to do. You know, I mean, just like metal is very about its traditions. It's almost got its own folklore and so on, you know, and of course you've got these big figureheads like Ozzy Osbourne, Bruce Dickinson, Rob Halford, who have been around for a really long time. They do have a certain kind of reverence about them, and I think it's deservedly so, because they are heroes to a lot of people. You know, people grew up wanting to be that guy on stage, you know, commanding tens of thousands of people and so on. It's a very aspirational and heroic sort of thing that I think people relate to, and I think it's a really, really healthy pastime as well.
Do you think you're going to be successful with this campaign?
You know, it's anyone's guess. I mean, I think the bottom line is, no matter what happens, this is going to have a very funny punchline. I mean, you know, we don't have any motives beyond just seeing if this thing is going to happen. You know, I'm blown away by the response it's had. But you know, this is really about amusement. I mean, we're doing it with our tongues planted firmly in our cheeks. We don't require any acknowledgement as to heavy metal's existence. We're pretty sure it exists.
There are very many subgroups, though, of heavy metal. Are you worried perhaps about factions and splits occurring in your religion?
Oh yeah. I mean, there could be a schism or two. You know, it's just like, I mean, metal prides itself on, you know, it's sort of ability to multiply into infinite fractions of genres and niche interest groups and all that, but we're all united under the same banner. You know, everyone knows that Black Sabbath are an amazing band. Everyone worships Iron Maiden, Metallica, and all that kind of thing. It's just we have our own interests, and I think it kind of speaks to the intelligence of the average metalhead, which kind of like breaks down the popular stereotype, because we perpetually debate the merits of one album over the other. You know, I mean, just like it's got this culture of debate and argument and, you know, kind of being miserable about everyone else but the stuff that you like specifically.
It's really amazing how many ideas are fueled by three pints in a pub, huh?
Indeed, indeed. Like all good, all good ideas, I think, are fueled by a bit of beer and all that, you know. But that's where it began, you know. Just like we thought it'd be funny, and you know, this is absolutely hilarious. We've had a few pints since then as well.
All right, Alexander. Thanks. Have one for me.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Alexander Milas is the editor of Metal Hammer magazine. He was in London, England. Dateline, San Francisco. As one wag said, a tablet hasn't created this much excitement since the Ten Commandments. And so it was with religious fervor that geeks around the world fidgeted away, waiting for today's announcement of the iPad. Now, in case you've been living in Antarctica in a cave under a glacier without Wi-Fi, you may not have witnessed the hype surrounding the Apple tablet, in which case you might be forgiven for thinking that the iPad was a customized seat cushion. What it is really is an e-reader and a computer and a phone and a video game console, and you ask it nicely, it'll make a souffle for you as well. All in a sleek, glassy enclosure that's about the size of a hardcover book, albeit a very thin one. Imagine an iPhone that's been flattened out with a rolling pin. That's what it looks like. And if you have around $500 burning a hole in your pocket, it's too big to fit in your purse, I mean, it's too big to fit in your pocket, you can get yourself one. And you can waltz around with it the way people once did with their iPods and their iPhones and whatever other iProduct people grabbed when it first came out. Because pretty soon, like the iPhone and the iPod, everybody will have the iPad, which will make the Apple tablet less cool, but still a bitter pill for Apple's competitors to swallow. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard from Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite 137, following the world at 6.
You can also listen to the whole show on the web. Just go to cbc.ca/AIH and link to our online archive. Thanks for listening. I'm Helen Mann.
And I'm Barbara Budd. Have a great week, everyone.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.